those movies, Israel was portrayed as an oppressed nation that was invaded by warmongering Arabs.
Now here's a country surrounded by five Arab nations ready to shove them into the Mediterranean. No guns, no tanks, no friends, nothing. People fighting with their bare hands for a little piece of desert. Because it's the last place on this whole earth that they can go to and try to live
in. Why did you come back?
It was very clear that the stars who stepped in to help Israel would not easily back down. In the last circle, it was always Israel that proved its ability to defend itself and its citizens with the final victory. While the Israelis were equipped both in the media and in practice, Nasser clearly assumed the leadership role in solving the Palestinian issue by establishing the Palestine Liberation Organization. The Arab League meeting in Cairo clearly proved to the Israelis that the Arabs were disunited. June 5, 1967, became the great test of the United Arab Nation. Israel attacked Egypt and captured the Sinai Desert. Israel also inflicted heavy defeats on the Arab armies on the Jordanian and Syrian fronts. The myth of Nasser, the dream of a united Arab nation, and the Palestinian refugees' dreams all collapsed in the Six-Day War and vanished into thin air. The Palestinians, under the leadership of Yasser Arafat, believe the only hope for the liberation of Palestine is the Palestinians themselves and no one else. They pinned all their wishes and dreams on Yasser Arafat. The most famous Palestinian fighter, Arafat managed to establish a left-wing nationalist guerrilla organization named the Fatah Organization in Jordan. To expand its activities and strengthen itself against the Zionist front, the Fatah Organization started recruiting new members. Solafa Jodala Mersal, a Palestinian woman who had studied photography in Cairo, was one of the new members who joined Fatah. She started a small photography studio in her apartment in Amman and set up photography equipment in her kitchen. Her main concern was to make commemorative pictures of the guerrillas and marchers. Mustafa Abu Ali and Hani Johariya, two Palestinians who had studied cinema and were living in Jordan, joined Mersal. They had worked for the Jordanian television for many years. They borrowed cameras from there and recorded everything as much as possible. Demonstrations, public gatherings, or any other political and cultural activities. And later on, a photography department was established and the first sparks of the Palestinian documentary cinema were formed from the heart of that structure.
There's no happening.
The 60s was a decade of the great rebellion of European filmmakers against Hollywood. Jean-Luc Godard, as the most famous filmmaker of the New Wave in France, was at the forefront of all the rebellions that targeted the capitalist system and the Hollywood studio system. In 1968, Godard, the most revolutionary anti-Hollywood filmmaker, went to Jordan. He visited the Palestinian camps, met Abu Ali, Hani, Johariyeh, and their friends, and filmed the refugee camps and guerrilla bases. He used the videos in a movie titled Here and Elsewhere. In the same year, the U.S. proposed a peace plan to the conflicting parties in the Middle East. The Palestinians objected and started a demonstration on the streets of Jordan. The experience of accompanying Palestinians with great revolutionary directors had awakened the dormant dreams of Abu Ali and his friends. When the photography department team, whose main members were Mustafa Abu Ali, Hani, Johariyeh, and Mersal, watched the recorded images of the demonstrations, they came to the conclusion that they have everything they needed to make a movie. So they started working and made a 20-minute movie called Say No to the Peace Plan. It was the first movie of resistance organizations. The movie was screened to the senior leaders of Fatah. The Palestinian leaders found something in the movie that became the main reason for their interest in cinema: the power of cinema in explaining the situation in the battlefield. The Revolution Cinema was the title Fatah leaders chose for the Palestinian cinema. Mustafa Abu Ali, in a statement, wrote for Palestine Film Foundation and highlighted the goals of the revolutionary cinema as follows. The sound of guns should be louder than any other sound. Light weapons are the people's main weapons in the war, and in the same way, light 16mm cameras are the most suitable weapon for the cinema about people. The success of a movie should be measured by the same criteria as the success of a military operation. They are both seeking to realize a political ideal.
We create a new people, and instead of being refugees, to be fighters. This is very important. We were refugees, homeless. We became now fighters, freedom fighters.
In the first step, the Palestinian cinema changed a stereotypical image of the Palestinian people. Now, after 20 years, the motivated pictures of the cinematographers replaced the image of the oppressed Palestinian refugees with that of fighting warriors. The Israelis could not put up with the Palestinians, who were now united to liberate their land. Soon enough, the conflict between Fatah and Israel began. Fatah guerrillas were the most important targets of Israel in its attacks on the Karameh village in Jordan. After Israel's rapid retreat, the battle became a legendary victory for the Palestinians, whose value doubled after the heavy defeat by the Arabs in the Six-Day War. Only in the first 48 hours after the end of the war, 5,000 Palestinians applied for membership in the organization. The Battle of Karameh initially brought about the unity of the Kingdom of Jordan and the Palestinians. But soon, the gaining of power by Fatah's guerrillas led to internal differences, and that got out of control and led to a widespread and bloody conflict. King Hussein of Jordan was targeted in an assassination attempt. The Jordanian army blamed the Palestinians. In September of 1970, King Hussein attacked the guerrillas' positions and pushed them back to the Syrian borders. Although the Fatah organization inevitably set up its organization once again in the south of Lebanon, the eventful years after exile left a deep impact on Palestinian society. Defeated by Israel and the West, disillusionment with the Arabs, the bad conditions of the refugees and displacement and isolation in Arab societies strengthened the unity of the people who were suffering from similar mental injuries. A narrative based on a common pain could act as a unifying factor. A great task was assigned to the Palestinian cinema, introducing the Palestinian national narrative instead of the failed idea of a united Arab nation. Making more than 60 documentary films was an answer to the need. The documentaries that were made those years were presented through a simple narrative that had a fixed pattern. It seems in these movies, all places are the same, and it's a collective situation for Palestinians. The soothing images of trees and orchards, even if they're just inside the refugee camps, they will suddenly be bombarded. The scenes of destruction and death after strikes are eventually replaced with the epic views of weapons, military training, and battle. The goal of recreating the battle scenes in these documentaries is to show a good ending to get rid of the pain of failure. By different means, the documentaries emphasize the correction of the past is made possible by referring to children or by depicting them. They are the manifestation of the future and hope against despair and disappointment of the past. In many scenes, the images of children are merged with the images of soldiers, followed by epic images of the Palestinian flag. These are the common symbols that continuously appear in Palestinian cinema and literature. They are the embodiments of hope, resurrection, and struggle. At first glance, this structure describes specific events, but since these stereotypes are repeated over and over in the form of similar scenes, it becomes something more than the recurring stereotypes. The most important achievement of the repetitive structure is the creation of a shared historical memory. The memory paints a unified picture of the Palestinian nation. As a result, geographically and socially, the divided community of refugees is united around a single memory. The memory of the United Palestinian Nation.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A United Nations body has issued a damning report blasting the United States regime for its rampant violations of a major human rights treaty that it ratified in 1992. Two-thirds of U.S. breaches of the Civil and Political Rights Covenant involve racial discrimination. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, ICCPR, enshrines the rights to life, to vote, and to freedom of expression and assembly, and the prohibition of torture and cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. It forbids discrimination in the enjoyment of civil and political rights based on race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. In its blistering November 3rd report, the UN Human Rights Committee, a group of 18 independent experts that monitors the implementation of the ICCPR, documented how little the US regime has done to challenge the systematic, wide-ranging racism that continues to infuse every aspect of the US society. Racial discrimination permitted two-thirds of the documented U.S. violations of the Human Rights Treaty. Jamil Dekawar, director of the ACLU's Human Rights Program, called the UN report scathing. Dekawar said in a statement, "The United States touts itself as a beacon of democracy and human rights, yet the committee's findings prove that this could not be further from the truth, underscoring the critical need to prioritize and strengthen human rights at home and establish a national human rights institution to ensure that our most basic rights are protected." Here are some of the committee's concluding observations, which are the culmination of its periodic review in Geneva last month. The committee expressed concern about violence, including mass shootings and hate speech, against Black people, indigenous peoples, Latinos, Asians, Muslims, as well as migrants, asylum seekers, and people targeted on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. An increase in gun-related deaths and injuries disproportionately affects racial and ethnic minorities, as well as women and children, the committee noted. It recommended a strengthening legislation requiring background checks and banning assault weapons. Discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity concerned the committee, which condemned the increase of severely restrictive state legislation, including criminalizing gender-affirming healthcare for persons and limiting discussions on sexual orientation and gender identity issues in school. The committee urged that discriminatory state laws be repealed and that the U.S. intensify its efforts to combat violence and discrimination in access to housing, health, employment, and in detention facilities. Criminalization of homelessness and violence against unhoused persons disproportionately impact people based on their race, real and perceived sexual orientation, and gender identity and disability. The committee which cited violence against homeless persons who are at higher risk of permit death due to homelessness, recommended the abolition of laws criminalizing homelessness. The report zeroed in on racial profiling, citing violations by law enforcement officials, including Customs and Border Protection and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, as well as targeting of ethnic and racial minorities, particularly Black people, Indigenous people, Latinos, and Muslims. Truth Out added, police brutality and the excessive and deadly use of force by law enforcement officials have a desperate impact on Black, Latino, and Indigenous peoples, as well as migrants and asylum seekers. The committee concluded, it urged bringing federal and state laws and policies into conformity with international principles on the use of force and firearms by law enforcement and UN guidelines on less lethal weapons in law enforcement. The report noted the overrepresentation of racial and ethnic minorities in the criminal legal system. They are disproportionately held in pretrial detention and placed on probation and parole, and are more often subject to prison labor and harsher sentences. The committee recommended reducing unnecessary criminal justice interventions, increased use of alternatives to incarceration, reasonable bail requirements, and parole and probation sentences that are necessary and proportionate to the offense. Racial disparities in the imposition of death penalty were also of concern to the committee, which recommended a moratorium at the federal level and concrete steps toward the abolition of capital punishment. U.S. officials were urged to strengthen safeguards against racist and wrongful sentencing and execution. Life imprisonment without possibility of parole similarly disproportionately affects Black people. The report also urged the U.S. regime to prohibit and abolish LWOP for juveniles and consider imposing a moratorium on the imposition of LWOP sentences. The committee was also concerned about discrimination on the basis of nationality, including residual effects from Donald Trump's now-revoked Muslim ban, prolonged delays in family reunification, and a backlog of visa applications persist. The committee suggested an accessible, fair, and effective reconsideration process for all visa applicants who continue to be affected by the ban, and additional measures to prevent future discriminatory bans. Of grave concern were recent U.S. policies that excessively restrict effective protection of the right to seek asylum. The committee was concerned that they may breach the principle of non-refoulement, which prohibits returning someone to a country where there is a substantial risk they will face torture, cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. The report also points to mandatory and prolonged detention, lack of access to counsel, and poor detention conditions, leading to the deaths of many detained people. More than 5,000 children were forcibly separated from their parents at the southern U.S. border, and hundreds still remain separated. The committee urged the U.S. to redouble its efforts to reunite all separated children with their families and prohibit future family separations. Children belonging to racial and ethnic minorities are overrepresented in the child welfare system and police presence in schools, part of the school-to-prison pipeline, disproportionately affects children of color. The committee advocated eliminating discriminatory bias in student discipline. The committee was concerned about human trafficking, including children, as well as the criminalization of victims of trafficking and limited access to effective protection, particularly for non-citizens who are at risk of becoming victims of forced labor. The committee recommended on-site inspections, especially in the agricultural sector, as well as measures to prevent the criminalization of sex trafficking victims. According to reports, the committee also highlighted violence against women, including domestic and sexual violence. Victims disproportionately include low-income women, Black, Latina, and Indigenous women, incarcerated women, and women with disabilities. The committee recommended effective implementation of the Violence Against Women Act and encouraged the states to pass legislation prohibiting and criminalizing female mutilation. The report added that the U.S. regime should redouble its efforts to protect against gender-based discrimination through Equal Rights Amendment and should consider ratifying the Convention on All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, and the lack of comprehensive data and resources, which hinders effective and culturally appropriate investigations, were also cited. Another focus was the lack of protection of indigenous lands and sacred sites from extractive industries, toxic and nuclear waste, and military infrastructure. The committee exhorted the U.S. to ensure meaningful and good faith consultations with indigenous peoples and ensure their active participation to obtain free, prior, and informed consent before taking any measures that can substantially affect their rights, way of life, and culture. The committee was concerned that climate change would threaten the right to life. It said it regretted the United States regime failed to provide specific information about what measures have taken to protect the most vulnerable people from the negative impacts of climate change and natural disasters. The committee cited concerns about various water crises across the United States, such as the leaking of high levels of lead into water systems and outbreaks of Legionnaires' disease in Flint, Michigan, disproportionately impacting Black and Indigenous peoples. The committee called on the U.S. to intensify its efforts to prevent and mitigate the effects of climate change and environmental degradation.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
This is a part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the issue of Palestine. Neither the Iranian Muslim nation nor any other Muslims, and as a matter of fact, no open-minded individual, will recognize Israel. We shall always support our Arab and Palestinian brothers. Quds belongs to the Muslims and must return to them. The issue of Quds is not a private or personal issue. It is neither the exclusive problem of one country. It is neither the exclusive problem of one country.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio This is Zainab Musavi and what we do in this program is to talk about some certain speeches and sentences of the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh and then shed light on some points and lessons in these speeches in order to be used by us in our everyday life Well, on the subject of sincerity, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, said, Nothing in the devotional act is as important as the intention and its sincerity. It is the sincere intention and pure purpose on which depend the perfection or defectiveness of ibadah or worship, and thus their validity or invalidity. Spiritual traits constitute the soul's primary character and intentions, to which actions are subservient, making up its secondary character. As long as self-love remains in the heart and a person remains in the oppressive habit of the self, he is not a wayfarer towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Rather, he is one of those who cling to the earth. Shirk in ibadah, that is some type of polytheism, encompasses all its levels in the inclusion of the good pleasure and satisfaction of anyone other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, whether it is the own self of somebody or someone else. If it is for someone else's satisfaction and for people, it is outward shirk and what we call in fiqh as riya. If a person expels the love of the world from his heart by means of self-discipline and persistent struggle against his mundane desires, he will be the same in solitude and company, inwardly and outwardly. And if someone leaves the habit of the self to migrate to God, as mentioned in the Holy Book of Quran, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم ومن يخرج من بيته مهاجرا إلى الله ورسوله ثم يدركه الموت فقد وقع أجره على الله. Whoever goes forth from his house, an immigrant to God and his messenger, and then death overtakes him, his wage will have fallen on God. If the person be such in this way and sets out on a spiritual journey, and thereafter he encounters complete annihilation, then his reward lies only with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that is a very beautiful point. Thank you very much for being with us in this episode. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
At least 2 million children in the United States have lost their Medicaid insurance this year. Many of the children were eligible for federal aid, according to experts, but errors have been common, as states unwind assistance from earlier in the coronavirus pandemic. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. At least 2 million children have lost their health insurance coverage since the end of the pandemic policy that guaranteed Medicaid coverage during the health emergency, according to a new report. Through November 8th, a total of about 10.1 million Americans have been disenrolled from Medicaid, the healthcare program for low-income Americans, according to researchers at the Georgetown Center for Children and Families and KFF, a health policy group. Roughly 18.4 million people have had their Medicaid coverage renewed, the report found. The 2 million children who have lost their coverage represent 21 states that break out enrollment changes by age, and it's likely an undercount because data is still coming in, according to Joanne Alker, executive director and research professor at Georgetown. States in April began removing people from Medicaid's rolls after the expiration of a pandemic provision that had suspended procedures to remove people from the program, such as if they earned too much money to qualify. But experts have warned that many qualified people are at risk of getting booted, including millions of American children, because of issues like paperwork snags or if their families relocated during the last few years. About 3 in 4 of the children who have lost Medicaid coverage are eligible for the program, Joanne Alker told CBS Money Watch. Governors who are not paying good attention to this process are dumping a lot of people off Medicaid, Alker added. Alker described the enrollment issues as particularly acute in Florida and Texas. She added, "There is no reason in the United States that children should be uninsured." The disenrollment of millions of American children and their families could prove to be a massive disruption in the social safety net, removing health care coverage for many of the nation's neediest families. While states and advocates prepared for the policy's unwinding, coverage losses are growing even among people still eligible, the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities said on Tuesday in an update. About 42 million children, more than half of all kids in the United States, are covered by Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, according to the American Pediatric Association. Ensuring children do not inappropriately lose their health care coverage is critical to supporting their health and well-being, the group said. The loss of health coverage for low-income children and their families come as more kids fell into poverty in 2022. The poverty rate for children doubled last year as government-funded pandemic aid dried up, including the end of the expanded child tax credit, and as parents' incomes shrank. ABC News KERO television in Bakersfield, California has also covered this story. Over 2 million children have lost their Medicaid coverage in the United States. Since April, many states have stopped Medicaid enrollment for low-income recipients as the federal policy guaranteeing health coverage during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic has ended. Now, a new analysis by health policy researchers from Georgetown Center for Children and Families and KFF states that as of this month, over 5 million Americans, including 2.2 million American children, have lost their health insurance. While it's not clear how many of these children may have found new coverage after the COVID-era ruling ended, researchers suggest these numbers might be significantly underestimated and could potentially be a larger number. 2 million children losing their Medicaid is a very high number, but it is an underestimate because of data lags between when states report unwinding disenrollments and when they report their current enrollment. Also, net figures reflect movement in and out of Medicaid, so more children are likely experiencing gaps in insurance coverage, researchers said. In 2021, the U.S. Census Bureau's American Community Survey counted 3.9 million uninsured children in America, which is why researchers believe the number could be a lot higher, since children who were eligible for federal assistance ended up losing their eligibility due to incomplete paperwork or mistakes made by state officials. Earlier this year, the Biden administration found flaws in the Medicaid system causing inappropriate coverage losses for children and some adults. Efforts to rectify the problem are ongoing, but the exact number of affected children is still unknown. Assuming that half of those children losing Medicaid have other sources of medical coverage, which seems somewhat optimistic, at least 1 million more children would be experiencing a period of uninsurance already. And the unwinding process has quite a ways to go yet, according to researchers. While the process of disenrollment is still ongoing across the United States, enrollment reductions also vary significantly among states, with California, Florida, and Texas leading in Medicaid disenrollments. Texas, in particular, is seeing the highest number of children losing their Medicaid coverage. The website MichiganAdvance.com has also covered this story. Despite federal warnings to slow down, both red and blue states have cut off Medicaid coverage for nearly 4 million people because they lack the proper paperwork. In at least 4 states, half of all the people who have lost their coverage for any reason are children. During the pandemic, the federal government directed states not to remove anyone from Medicaid, the Joint Federal-State Healthcare Program for Low-Income People and People with Disabilities. But states were cleared to resume eligibility and paperwork checks starting on 1st of April this year. Nearly three-quarters of the roughly 5.4 million Medicaid recipients who've lost coverage were terminated because of procedural reasons, according to an analysis from KFF, a healthcare policy research organization. Those removals happened due to an incomplete renewal process, whether because of missing paperwork, outdated contact information, or a renewal form not sent by a specified date. This month, the Center for Medical and Medicaid Services mailed letters to every state saying long waiting times and high procedural termination rates might violate federal regulations to keep those who are eligible enrolled. The letters came weeks after federal officials raised concerns about overzealous efforts to purge the rolls and gave states extra flexibility to re-enroll patients. Some states, such as Maine, have paused removals.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Africa has a long history of solidarity with Palestine. 50 years ago, after the October 1973 war between the Israeli apartheid regime and some Arab armies, most African countries decided to cut off ties with the Israeli regime in solidarity with Arab countries. Now, the move came after the Organization of African Unity, OAU, the precursor to the African Union, called on member states to break off relations with the Israeli apartheid regime. Additionally, the Organization of African Unity, in its 12th ordinary session held in Kampala in 1975, became the first international body to recognize on a large scale the inherent racism in Israel's Zionist ideology. In February this year, a senior Israeli regime's diplomat was forcefully removed from the African Union's annual summit in Ethiopia after the regime's observer status at the bloc was suspended. Now, amid the genocidal war that the Israeli regime has been waging against this Gaza Strip, there are growing calls for African countries to take a similar decision they took 50 years ago. So, will African Union once again lead the continent in breaking ties with the Israeli apartheid regime? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. In this week's episode, we are focusing on growing calls by African people that their governments should cut off ties with the Israeli apartheid regime over its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza.
Will Africa cut ties with Israel? The people of Africa have been protesting against the ongoing Israeli apartheid regime's genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. The protest marches have attracted people from various religious denominations, including Muslims, Christians, and Jews. Many protesters are calling for a total economic boycott of Israel and have urged their government to end diplomatic ties with this racist regime.
Prominent South African anti-apartheid activist Reverend Alan Boysak participated in a pro-Palestinian demonstration in Cape Town recently, where he called for the shutting down of the Israeli embassy in the country.
Palestinians can do nothing while their children are dying. They can do nothing with words when they are dying of hunger, when they are being bombed, when churches and mosques and hospitals are being bombed. Then words are no longer enough. I think what this government must do and must do immediately is that this embassy of the Israeli government should be shut down. We should brand officially the Israeli government as an apartheid government.
For more analysis on calls for Africa to cut all ties with the Israeli regime, we have contacted Jamia Gallant, the chairperson of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign of Cape Town, South Africa. Thank you for your time, madam.
Thank you for inviting me.
We also have with us today Zahid Rajan, the coordinator of Kenyans for Palestine Movement. Thank you, Mr. Rajan, for your time.
Thank you.
Now, 50 years ago, in 1973, most African countries decided to end their diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime. Now, Mr. Rajan, what was the main factor behind this solidarity move?
Thank you. It's not only the Arab-Israeli war. I think the African diplomatic relations with Israel finally broke when Africa took a step against Israel's support of the apartheid regime in South Africa, obviously in link with the US. And I think that was the main reason why Africa as a whole took a stand to say that we're breaking off diplomatic relations with Israel. I think that is more of a reason for Africa taking that stand.
Now, let's bring in Ms. Jamia Gallant. We are witnessing the Israeli apartheid regime committing unprecedented crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Now, unlike in 1973, we are yet to see African countries taking a united front in ending ties with the Israeli regime. What could be the reason behind this?
Okay, well, I think the world has changed since 1973, to be honest. I think all of the post-colonial regimes that we have in Africa at the moment has been bought by big capital. So we've seen an increase in neo-imperialist interventions in Africa, including Israel. And so we have a kind of the condition under which the post-colonial states in Africa have been muted in any response that they may have given at another time, because particularly of the kind of the dependencies of the political elites in all of these countries, who have in many different ways collaborated with powerful global interests, including the US, and of course by proxy all of its allies. And so they very much constrained at this point, as we have seen at the AU itself.
Some African countries have started to take steps to boycott the Israeli regime diplomatically. The South African government has also said it will recall all diplomats from Israel to signal its concern over the situation in Gaza. South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor says that the nature of response by Israel has become one of collective punishment. Chad has also recalled its charge d'affaires to the Israeli regime for consultations.
Latin American countries have been more resolute in condemning Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, and even some of them have cut ties with the Israeli regime. The permanent representative of Bolivia to the United Nations, Diego Opari Rodriguez, elaborates here on his country's decision to cut ties with the Israeli apartheid regime.
Bolivia has the utmost respect for international law, for the Charter of the United Nations, and for the member states. And we will go down on the right side of history. We are on the side of the rights of the Palestinian people. As a result, the people and government of Bolivia has taken the decision to break diplomatic ties from today with the state of Israel, because we consider it a state that does not respect life of peoples, of international law or international humanitarian law.
Well, we've had the Bolivian envoy to the UN announcing that his country is cutting ties with the Israeli regime. Now, Mr. Raja, this for you. Why are African countries not taking similar measures against the Israeli apartheid regime?
There have been protests, and I think you need to distinguish between what governments say and what the people do. So you cannot equate the support of African government for Israel to the African solidarity by the African people for Palestine. We have 54 countries on the African continent, and that distinction needs to be made. We've had great acts of solidarity from Kenya, from South Africa, from Nigeria, from Senegal, from Tanzania, from Malawi, and so on and so forth. So there have been acts of solidarity, there have been demonstrations, there have been public statements.
There was a time that Africa had young revolutionary leaders who spoke out fearlessly against imperialists and Zionists. Many African leaders are now not ready to come out strongly and openly to condemn the Israeli apartheid regime.
Any statements condemning Israel will immediately impact these leaders' relationships with the U.S., and they cannot afford to do that. In fact, we've just seen that demonstrated in South Africa just yesterday amidst the current catastrophe unfolding. We still had a meeting of African states and labor leaders with the president of the United States being here. So the close alliance between the United States and Israel is, I think, one of the biggest factors that mutes any response from African leaders to condemn the Israeli apartheid regime.
Before occupying Palestine, Zionists had considered settling in Kenya during the British colonial rule. On August 26, 1903, the founding father of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, had proposed that Jews settle in present-day Western Kenya. However, this evil plan did not succeed. The existence of such a scheme should be enough to jolt African governments to join the people in the continent in strongly rejecting the Israeli colonial entity and supporting the liberation of Palestine. Mr. Rajan, this is for you. What's your opinion on this plan and the need for African countries to support the liberation of Palestine?
Thank you for your question. We are acutely aware of Israel's plan to actually take over Kenya and Uganda like they've done Palestine. So we are acutely aware of this historical fact and appalled by it that they even thought about that. But that's not surprising. I mean, considering that Kenya in particular and Africa as a whole have been a victim of colonial and neo-colonial rule, and that it is only in the interest of the colonialists to capture, colonize, and occupy any part of the world for their own benefit. And I think in that sense, the African countries are very well aware, and that is where the solidarity comes from, in the sense that we have been victims of colonialism and neocolonialism now. We are acutely aware of what colonialism did to our people and the heroic struggle that the African people waged against colonialism to get independence. And so we are completely in solidarity with Palestine, because we understand that Israel is a settler colonial state that have occupied Palestine. And that sense, our solidarity with Palestine is unconditional and unequivocal. We stand with Palestine, and just like Mandela said, that the freedom of Africa is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinian people.
Well, thank you for that, Zahid Rajan. We'll now take a short break before we continue with our show. So stay with us.
Will Africa cut ties with Israel?
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Africa Today. And this week, we are also focusing on the Israeli regime's genocidal war on Gaza amid calls for African countries to cut off ties with his criminal regime. The Algerian parliament on November 2nd unanimously voted to authorize President Abdelmadjid Tebboune to enter the current war in Gaza and throw his support behind Palestine. Now, the move by the Algerian parliament is in tandem with the sentiments of the masses in this North African country, where demonstrations continue to take place and people turning out in large numbers to express solidarity with Palestinians.
Obviously, the Palestinian people and the Algerian people are of the same blood, speak with the same voice, be it the rulers, the people. Algeria has always been with the Palestinian cause.
Well, indeed, the Algerian people, just like people in the rest of Africa, are standing with Palestine. Now, this question is for Ms. Gallant. What's your view on the historic decision by the Algerian parliament to support Palestinians militarily?
I think it's excellent, and it is to be welcomed, because the decision really is testimony to the recognition of the genocide that is currently unfolding in Palestine. It is a recognition that there needs to be a new axis of support for Palestine to counter the backing that Israel gets from the Western global powers. At the moment, we do not have that kind of axis of support for Palestine. Many of the Arab states, as you've asked me about the African states, who are muted in their condemnation of Israel, so too are some of the Arab states, precisely not because of the normalization so much of relations with Israel, but very much because of their dependency and reliance on the United States. And so for Algeria to come out and make that decision,